Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Peter Pace went to Capitol Hill for a second day today to face some tough questions from skeptical lawmakers about the president's new strategy for Iraq. Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy questioned the Iraqi government's commitment to the plan.
Iraqi leader Prime Minister Maliki failed to appear at a news conference and avoided any public comment. Now we're asking American people to support an increase in sending American servicemen over there, warriors over there, when we have this kind of reaction.
That's Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy during testimony today in Washington about the president's new plan for Iraq. Well, joining us now is Peter Greer. He's Washington editor of the Christian Science Monitor. He's joining us from the Monitor studios to talk about the latest from the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing today. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, well, as they did yesterday, Democrats criticizing the president's plan for more than 20,000 additional U.S. troops in Iraq. We heard from Republican John McCain, who defended the plan today. But pretty interesting here to note that former committee chairman John Warner only said, quote, "This is a credible product worthy of very careful consideration." Not exactly a ringing endorsement. What does that mean, Peter?
Well, not exactly a ringing endorsement. That's true. That's not a big surprise. However, Senator Warner has been sounding somewhat cool about the U.S. in military involvement in Iraq for some time. You'll recall a few months ago he said that it seemed like we were kind of slipping sideways there, which also was not exactly a ringing endorsement. Though I must say, in today's hearing at the Senate Armed Services Committee, the administration witnesses did not get truly hammered. You know, yesterday, in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is full of Democrats and some Republicans who want to run for president, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice really got hammered. So that was a much tougher day, I think, for the administration than today's been so far.
Right. But Secretary Gates did not get hammered yesterday, right? So it's sort of, maybe it's the person. I don't know.
Oh, that could be. That could be. I have great regard for the Senate Armed Services Committee. I mean, that as a whole, it is kind of the way that you would hope the Senate is run, in which both the majority and the minority members have a pretty high regard for each other and work together.
Let's listen to some of the testimony. Senator McCain asked General Pace and Secretary Gates to sketch out what might happen under the Democratic proposal to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq in about 4 to 6 months.
Sure. If we announce a withdrawal, I think our enemies just simply hold their breath and wait for us to get out of town.
If we withdraw and the situation descends into chaos, which I think most people believe is a very real possibility.
What do you believe?
I think it is highly likely that there would be a significant increase in sectarian violence in Iraq, that the government would probably begin to come apart, that the army might come apart.
And that's Defense Secretary Gates talking about the plan to withdraw U.S. troops in about 4 to 6 months from Iraq. A lot of skepticism there, Peter Greer, and also some skepticism because what's going to happen next? The Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, says he's got the votes to block any legislation expressing disapproval of the president's plan. Do you believe that?
I'm not a vote counter in Congress. I'm more of a foreign policy and defense person, so you'd have to ask the congressional reporters. But it just seems to me, from listening to the tenor of the comments over the last several days, that it's possible it has the votes, and it's also possible he does not have the votes because, you know, there are many Republicans in the Senate who have been staunch supporters of the president who are sounding pretty iffy about this plan.
Mm-hmm. And just briefly, Peter, what about the questions about the commitment on the Iraqi side here?
Well, you know, you see, to me, I think that was really one of the most interesting things that's come out both today and to a certain extent yesterday. Secretary Gates today in the Senate Armed Services Committee basically committed himself to a couple of interesting timeframes. On the one hand, he's pointed out that the Iraqis have to start moving their own forces, have promised to start moving their own forces into Baghdad soon, that there's a unit should move by February 1st. For example, and another by February 15th. If those units are not moved, Secretary Gates said, well, quote, we may have to reevaluate our strategy.
All right. Peter Greer, Washington editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, a caucus of Democrats who want the U.S. out of Iraq heard from another progressive from the Vietnam era, former Senator George McGovern, who galvanized the anti-war left in 1972, but lost the presidential election then to Richard Nixon. McGovern was among those in today's meeting. Rick Klein is Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. He was at the meeting. And Rick, what did you hear from former Senator McGovern? He's been calling for, what, a six-month withdrawal from Iraq?
That's right. He really wants troops to be out very, very quickly, and he drew very heavily on Vietnam analogies with his own experience, as well as World War II analogies as a World War II veteran, and he just pronounced the entire war a disaster and said at one point, quote, every month we delay, another 100 of these brave young American soldiers will die. And he went on to say, look, I'm not a pacifist. I actually served in the war, unlike people like Vice President Cheney and President Bush, who had their opportunity to serve in Vietnam. But really, this is the wrong strategy, the wrong time, and it has to change and has to end. And he was greeted very warmly by the lawmakers who were there. All of them are very strong supporters of ending the war.
Mm-hmm. So the mood among them, were they galvanized? How would you describe it? Are they frustrated by Congress? I mean, what's happening there?
There's a deep frustration, I think, that Congress isn't moving fast enough. And in fact, Jack Murtha, the Pennsylvania Democrat, who's close to Nancy Pelosi and is head of the important appropriations subcommittee that looks at defense issues, gave voice to some of that frustration and said he would try to use his committee to close the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, close Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, as well as attach a lot of conditions that would force the president not to do any kind of escalation in troops in Iraq. This is really the furthest he'd gone in terms of outlining his strategy. Not clear whether it has the votes to pass, but I think that's some measure of the frustration of the anti-war left, that the Democratic Congress isn't moving fast enough to rein in the war.
All right. Well, Rick Klein, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe, thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And in this week where the U.S. is debating a change of strategy in Iraq, we thought we'd take some time to consider a pivotal battle in a very different war, the World War II American victory on the island of Iwo Jima, as portrayed in film. Because of its air bases, Iwo Jima was crucial territory for the U.S. to capture in its drive toward the Japanese homeland, but for both sides, the price was high. Though outnumbered, the Japanese troops on the island refused to surrender. Instead, they entrenched themselves in tunnels and caves to inflict maximum casualties on the U.S. Marines who landed there in February 1945. More than 6,800 Marines were killed. Some 20,000 Japanese soldiers lost their lives. Academy Award-winning director Clint Eastwood has taken on the subject of Iwo Jima in not one, but two films. In December, he released Flags of Our Fathers, which looked at the Marines who raised the flag on Mount Suribachi, as seen in the famous Associated Press photo. And in Letters from Iwo Jima, which begins its nationwide release this month, Eastwood looks at the battle from the other point of view. Filmed almost entirely in Japanese, Letters from Iwo Jima focuses on General Tadamichi Kuribayashi, the architect of the Japanese strategy, as played by Ken Watanabe. Here he is addressing the troops before battle. That's Ken Watanabe in the new film, Letters from Iwo Jima. And joining us to talk about this film is Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Welcome.
Thank you.
This subject of the Battle of Iwo Jima, from the point of view of the losing side, how unusual is that?
That's fairly unusual, especially as it concerns the Japanese. There have been American war films told from the German point of view in World War II. The Young Lions, there are a number of others. Hollywood really hasn't come to grips before with the Japanese side on its own. In the movie Tora, 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 we learned about certain key battles and Pearl Harbor from both sides. You saw the American side and you saw the Japanese side. What Eastwood is doing, he's actually taken that approach and split it into two films, which is very unusual. And the films are about two different things, not just here's one side of the battle, here's the other side. The American film is concerned really with notions of heroism, what heroism means in the greater culture, and what it means on the battlefield. Letters from Iwo Jima is really about the idea of glory versus survival. I mean, what exactly drives men in war and what happens to them when they're actually in the middle of it.
Right. Somehow, though, when we talk about films that have been done from another point of view, from the point of view of the enemy, this one feels very different, and I think the soldiers were portrayed in a different way.
I completely agree, especially as it concerns the Japanese. As I was saying before, it's easier to look at the enemy for Hollywood when you're talking about the Germans. The Japanese have long been demonized in Hollywood films, even in more subtle ways today. This is a film that doesn't do that, that actually goes in the opposite direction. It humanizes them at the same time that it makes very clear that there were two types of people in the Japanese Imperial Army, and in fact, two types of people in war, you know, wherever it takes place, the ideologues and the grunts, the ones who are drawn by notions of glory and are willing to kill themselves and everybody else for an idea, and the ones who are in the thick of it and realize they need to survive. And yet there's a humanism and a grace to the characterizations, especially between the different levels of the men, from the general, played
right,
by
General Kurabayashi.
Ken Watanabe, to the baker soldier, played by Kazunari Ninomiya, who's one of the main characters of the film. And they actually grow closer and closer together through as the film progresses, partially because there's less and less men around them, but also because they're coming to occupy the same sort of moral territory.
Right. And when we talk about General Kurabayashi in this film, who's played by Ken Watanabe, I think that is very unusual, isn't it, to have a general portrayed in sort of a sympathetic...
Well, he's a fascinating character. He had been to America. He was very admiring of America and Americans and our culture. And he, I think, as many people did in the Japanese Army, you know, understand what he was up against. And he also certainly understood what he was up against, you know, when he came to Iwo Jima. So Eastwood does create a very sympathetic portrait, and Watanabe does, you know, make him a full three-dimensional man.
Right. Now, this film was already released in Japan first, and what's been the reaction there?
My understanding is that the studio, faced with these two films, decided to, sensibly enough, market Flags of Our Fathers to America first and Letters from Iwo Jima to Japan first and then see what happens. What happened was that Flags of Our Fathers got respectful but not enthusiastic reviews. Letters from Iwo Jima, on the other hand, got rave reviews in Japan. It really became a cultural touchstone. A lot of, I've heard stories of men whose fathers were in the war going to see it and, you know, coming out in tears. I mean, it's becoming a real catharsis for Japan. And I think the distributors realized that this was their Oscar movie, their best shot at Oscar.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it has a serious chance for a nomination this year?
Oh, I think it definitely has a serious chance for a nomination, although you get into an interesting argument as to whether it's a foreign language film or whether it belongs in Best Picture or both. But Letters from Iwo Jima has a serious enough purpose and has been executed with such elegance and simplicity that you have to respect it. And it's extremely moving.
Oh, all right. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. His new book, The Best Old Movies for Families, comes out next month. Well, we've heard Ty's opinion of the film. When we come back, we'll hear the thoughts and the memories of two American veterans of Iwo Jima. And later in the show, with scandals at both Apple Computer and Hewlett-Packard, we look at business ethics in the high-tech world. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about Clint Eastwood's film Letters from Iwo Jima, which shows the Japanese side of that decisive World War II battle in which the Japanese, trapped and outnumbered on the island, refused to surrender to overwhelming American forces. We're joined now by two men who saw the film and the battle. David Swerdlow was a medic with the 4th Marine Division. John Welsh was with the 1st Marine Division. Both of you were invited to screen the film by Dennis McCarthy. He then wrote about your reactions in the Los Angeles Daily News. And we'll talk about the film in just a moment. But John Welsh, let's start with you first. When did you enlist and why?
What decided was Pearl Harbor. As soon as I turned 17, I joined the Marines, went into the service with my two brothers and my father.
And then you ended up fighting on Iwo Jima. What happened there? Can you describe?
What happened, it was just different type of island. That sand, that Iwo Jima volcanic stuff come above your boots, and it was hard. You couldn't run. In the picture, it's showing some of the guys running, so I don't think it was that was too authentic, but Clint Eastwood did a real good job on showing the human side of the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to David Swerdlow for a moment. David, you were a medic in the Marines, and I'm wondering, there's a scene in the film where some of the Japanese troops are told to target medics because one medic is worth quite a few soldiers. What did you think when it got to that scene of the movie?
To be honest with you, I wasn't aware that they were planning to take the medics and use them as target practice, or not practice, but to hit the medics.
They wanted to.
I was off the island at that when I found that out. That was really scary.
Those medics were really great. Hi, guy. They just were going from one guy to another. They were the greatest.
Thank you,
David. Well, let's hear your story just briefly. What happened? You were at Iwo Jima for a short time. Is that right?
Well, what happened in my case? I was the luckiest man in the world because I landed, and as I was running up to the beach there to the position, I was bending over a tank that had been knocked out, and I was sort of protecting myself. And the next thing I know, one of my own men told me that blood was coming out of my leg, and I'd been shot to the ankle bone. And believe it or not, I never even felt it. From there on, I was evacuated. So actually, I was only on the island not more than 30 minutes. So I would say that I was a very fortunate individual because it was just hell to pay. It's hard to even describe the bullets and shells.
I think the biggest thing, don't you, that when they had the battleships just firing salvo
right.
after salvo, it shook the ground so much, and
right.
it seemed like a freight train going overhead. We just thought they'd never stop. And I went for about an hour and a half. But then they brought in the carriers, and they chipped away with about 700 rounds. And the clouds and the black powder and the volcanic gas that come up, you couldn't see anything.
It was
scary.
It was gunfire like you never saw before in your life. And the fact is that just thinking in my own head, that's my last day on Earth. I didn't see how I ever could survive it.
David, after seeing the Clint Eastwood movie then, the Letters from Iwo Jima movie, do you think that that helps you have a better understanding of the Japanese now than you did then, certainly?
Oh, yes. Well, I'll tell you, the way I really felt about it was I was very sad. I was very sad because the whole thing wasn't even necessary. 21,000 Japs were entrapped on that island, and looking out, there was 70, 80,000 Americans. No way could they be a winner. They were taught to fight to the last man. That was the message of the military. And 20,000 of them died, which wasn't necessary, and about 1,000 of them were taken prisoner.
John Welsh, after you saw the film, did it help you understand the Japanese better?
I'll tell you, this changed my mind on a lot of things. I won't go to a sushi store with Japanese food or nothing, but I have a lot more respect for them because I saw them guys that wanted to write letters that I had seen and couldn't read, but you could tell what they were. They were writing to their girlfriends, their mother and their father, their sisters and brothers, to their families, just like the Marines did.
David, would you say that your feelings were as strong as John's, and what was your motivation to enlist?
I always felt that, you know, you're in the military, you want to kill, that's your objective. But the longer I stayed in the Marine Corps and I was in the Medical Corps, I lost that feeling about wanting to kill. I was proud of myself that I never had to kill anyone, that I was able to take care of the wounded and the sick.
Good. The medics, they deserve a lot.
Well, practically every man in my company was wounded or killed. I'm one of the lucky survivors.
And I think that Clint Eastwood did one hell of a good job on Iwo Jima except for the sand part. You couldn't run in that stuff.
Actually, that saved my life. The sand would just cave in, and it was quicksand. If I'd been up there sooner, I'd have been hidden by the tank.
You know, being a BAR man, Bradley automatic rifle, I had a gun belt around my 240 rounds of ammunition plus two bandoliers. And going through that sunk right up above my ankles, right down in that sand.
It sounds like it was so horrible.
It was.
Oh, man, truly, it was. He knows. It was hell. They fired down. The guys were just being killed one right after another. And I was just like him, but I was more fortunate than him. He got hit.
Before we landed on Iwo Jima, I heard a few of the Marine captains say that 50% of us won't be coming back, so prepare yourself. And so it was just, like they said, it was hell, that's all. And that's the only word I could use.
Well, gentlemen, thanks very much to both of you for being with us.
Sure.
You take care, and I'll be in touch with you.
John Welsh and David Swerdlow are American veterans of the Battle of Iwo Jima. The film, Letters from Iwo Jima, opens this month. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Funding for Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. A private investigator involved in the Hewlett-Packard spying scandal has struck a deal with federal prosecutors. 29-year-old Brian Wagner pleads guilty to identity theft and conspiracy in California today. He faces at least 2 years in prison, and he's agreed to testify for the prosecution. Wagner's accused of stealing a journalist's Social Security number and using it to access the reporter's phone records. Hewlett-Packard admitted last year that it had spied on and gained access to phone records of HP board members and journalists as part of an investigation into boardroom leaks to the media. We're going to talk about this story as well as the controversy over backdated stock options at Apple Computer with business ethicist and New York Times columnist Jeff Seglin, who joins us in the studio. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
Can you remind us how this whole Hewlett-Packard case started and the pretexting issue and exactly what it is in a nutshell here?
Well, pretexting is pretending you're someone else to get someone's information over the phone. Hewlett-Packard hired people to pretend they were somebody to get other people's records. They did that to find out about who was leaking information about what the company was doing, and they did that to board members at the company, and then they also did it to journalists who were covering the company because information was getting out about what the company was doing. And the odd thing was is that it wasn't necessarily bad things about the company. It was some of it was good things about the company. So it was just a bizarre situation where the chairwoman of the board at the time wanted to crack down on it. So
Patricia Dunn.
Mm-hmm. So she hired people to find out who was leaking the information.
And one of them was Brian Wagner, who's entering this plea today.
Yes, now, he was one of the investigators.
Right, he was one of the people hired to look into some of these things. What's his role in all this? I mean, is he sort of way down the totem pole here and the first person who's really going to take the fall from this?
He's very low on the totem pole, and I'm sure that what's happening is that they would like to use him to get more information. Who they really want to get is Patricia Dunn and the other people who are higher up in the organization to send a message to corporate America, you're responsible, don't do this. Patricia Dunn is facing health issues, so the longer this drags out, the more unfortunate it is. I mean, she's had ovarian cancer for a long time.
Congressional hearings were held on this whole issue before the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. Anything changed because of this scandal? Has anything really happened?
Hope people know enough not to fabricate information to pretend they're someone else to get people's phone records. I think one of the things that's changed is people are looking at the laws to make sure that that kind of practice is clearly illegal. I think there was some question about what's illegal and what's not, and it varied from state to state. I think they're looking at trying to make sure that there's a uniform way of making sure that that kind of practice is illegal. I think one of the things that's clear is that everybody knows it's wrong. Not everybody's clear that it's illegal.
Right.
And I think that's one of the cases where you know something's unethical, but you stand around and you say, well, it's unethical, but can we do it? Mm-hmm. And that's where the difference between ethics and law come into play. Just because it's legal doesn't make it right.
Another major business story this week was Apple Computer. As Apple is unveiling, and Steve Jobs of Apple is unveiling the Apple iPhone, there is a controversy about backdating at the company. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Steve Jobs is alleged to have received stock options in December of 2001 and said that he received them in October of 2001, which is backdating. It's saying that you received the stock options earlier than you received them.
And what, why would he do that?
And what's the reason he would do that is the stock option price matters because a stock option is an option to buy a stock at today's price at a much later date. If you backdate it even by a couple of months, the stock price is going to be that many months lower.
Right.
And that's what Steve Jobs is accused of doing.
So then you get to buy it at the lower price
later.
Right.
And okay, the difference between the price on October 2001 and December 2001 amounts to millions of dollars. They had Apple's board look at it and to see if Steve Jobs did anything wrong. And the board, one of whose members is Al Gore, exonerated Steve Jobs and said he didn't appear to be doing anything wrong. And now the SEC is looking at it to see if anything was done wrong as a result of it. This is another case where even if it's legal to backdate stock options, which I'm not quite certain it is, and if it is, I'm not quite certain it should be. It's another case where the question of whether it's ethical is a big question because it defeats the purpose of having the stock options. If you issue the stock options on a particular date, that's the date that the price should be in effect.
Right. The Wall Street Journal actually ran a column saying that people are overreacting here, that this isn't fraud or theft or anything else.
Well, it's not fraud or theft, but when you talk about the difference between a stock price in October of 2001 and December of 2001, and the difference can mean millions of dollars, it might not mean much to an editorial writer in the Wall Street Journal, but it means a lot to normal people who are walking the street. So you have to know what the motive of the people doing it is. And I think it was Holman Jenkins' piece in the,
right,
in the Wall Street Journal, and his point was that if no one knows they're breaking the law, are they really breaking the law? And my response to that is, of course they're breaking the law. Someone knew they were backdated. Someone should have said, no, we can't do this. Like I said, $1 million is a lot. It is to me. I'm assuming it is to you as well.
It is.
I don't know if it's a lot to Steve Jobs.
Right.
You know, he made a big deal out of saying he was taking a dollar to be CEO of the company. Well, this makes it a lot clearer why maybe he took a dollar to be CEO of the company.
Right.
It's just, it seems to me that even if it's legal, it's not an ethical thing to do because the whole idea of options is that it's supposed to be a motivator for people within the company. And you're saying, I will gamble that this company's stock price will go up. And I'm willing to take the risk that it won't go down, but I'll live with it if it does. So I will live with the stock price on this particular day. But you don't get to say that if I start on December and I take that stock price on December, you're going to backdate it to October. It's, yeah, it's not fair and it's not right. So even if the Wall Street Journal says everybody's doing it and it's not that big a deal, doesn't make it so.
What do you think is going to happen to him? I mean, he is Apple Computer, really.
Right.
I mean, he's celebrity status in a way, I guess you could say. How important is he to Apple, and what do you think will be the fallout?
Well, I think he's very important to Apple,
right,
and I don't know that there will be much of a fallout. I think there's no indication that anybody was trying to deliberately defraud somebody here. I think it's a mess, and I think it's, if anything, it's an indication of how messy the whole issue of stock option accounting is, and it needs to be cleaned up. And I think if anything comes out of this, the most positive thing that could come out of it is for the SEC to come in and say, you cannot do this and it must stop. Steve Jobs is very important to Apple. He wasn't CEO for a period of time, and the company didn't do as well when he wasn't CEO, and he came back in and he did it. In the long term, Apple's going to have to, if it's going to succeed, it's going to have to succeed beyond Steve Jobs. And if he's a good CEO, he'll figure out a way to create a succession plan so that it will succeed.
And we should say that Apple stock and Hewlett Packard stock both seem to be doing pretty well. So.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's the Woody Allen line, you know, at the end of Annie Hall, where the brother who thinks he's a chicken, and they ask him, why don't you tell him he's not a chicken? They say, because we need the eggs. And I think it's, you know, the companies, Hewlett Packard has gotten through tough times, but they make good products that people like. And Apple, the iPod, has been a tremendous success and continues to be a tremendous success. And I think that to keep things in perspective, these are not good things that are happening, but they're not at all on the level of egregious violations that happened during the scandals of WorldCom or Enron, where people's retirement pension funds were just eviscerated as a result of the misbehavior of CEOs.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
Jeff Seglin is a business ethicist and New York Times columnist. He also writes a blog about business and ethics. And for a link to his blog, go to our website, here-now.org. From the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Alabama to the top of the bluegrass charts, the music of Bradley Walker is still to come. You're listening to Here and Now. This weekend promises some great games for football fans as the NFL playoffs continue. But the big sports news today is about the other football. We call it soccer here in America. And the news is that world-class midfielder and brand unto himself David Beckham and his wife, former Spice Girl Victoria, are headed for Los Angeles. Beckham has signed a 5-year, $250 million deal to play for the LA Galaxy. And here to talk about that and other news from the world of sports is Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Bill, nice to see you again, as always.
It's good to see you too, Deb. And it's posh Spice, isn't it? I've had to educate myself on these things the last 24 hours.
It is posh Spice. I believe it's posh, yes. It is. Well, David Beckham coming to America, he says one of his top priorities, first thing he wants to do is to try to make sure that professional soccer gets its due here in this country. Big job. Is he up to the job? Is this what soccer needs in this country, Bill?
Well, Major League Soccer certainly hopes that this is the shot in the arm that the industry needs, because it is an extraordinarily expensive injection. $250 million is the number that's been thrown around, and probably required several people to lift it before they could throw it. Very big number. The day that and this may be an index of his impact, the day that the announcement was made, the Los Angeles Galaxy sold 1,000 season tickets. That'll pay for about 12 minutes of David Beckham's time, by my calculation. No, it's ridiculous. I mean, the numbers are ridiculous. One hopes that because his image is so prevalent around the world, and he has previously sold so many jerseys playing for Manchester United and playing for Real Madrid, that he will somehow do something similar for Major League Soccer in general and the Galaxy in particular. But we'll see. We'll see whether it works.
And how much, really, is the image at play here, would you say, Bill? Because he really, I mean, honestly, hasn't been playing all that well lately.
Well, he lost his captaincy of the English team. He's no longer a member of the national team in England, and he has been sitting much more often than he's been playing for Real Madrid this season in Spain. So there are those who say, hey, they're getting, it's the old story. There was a fella interviewed in a pub in England about this event, and he said, David Beckham is rubbish, and rubbish goes to America.
Well.
I don't think it's quite that simple in this case. He still can play. There are lots of soccer people who say there still is no better player in terms of the set piece, the dead ball, the shot launched from 30 yards out, the corner kick, that sort of thing. And that may well be true. And at 31, he may not be able to run the field as well as, he once could, and he certainly won't have the same sort of dramatic impact on soccer in this country as Pelé had when he came to play in the North American Soccer League. But it almost doesn't matter. He's Beckham. He's bigger than all these concerns.
Right, but what about lessons from the whole Pelé incident? I mean, are they being repeated? Are some of the things being repeated here, Bill?
I certainly hope not, because although in the short term Pelé lent credibility to professional soccer in America, and he attracted numbers of other fellows to come from Europe and from Latin America to play, in the long term, the foolishness of the way the North American Soccer League spent its money meant that the league stopped existing. And So I certainly hope that there won't be a parallel that extends to that conclusion.
Mm. Let's go on to American football now. Saturday, Baltimore Ravens at Indianapolis. This is a matchup with the Colts that has a lot of history.
Yes, there's some history here, of course, because it used to be the Baltimore Colts, and in the dead of night back a couple of decades ago, 84, Robert Irsay took the Colts out of town in the infamous Mayflower moving trucks. And lots of people have never forgiven him, and lots of people living in Baltimore still consider themselves Baltimore Colts fans, the way I suppose there are still people living in Brooklyn who consider themselves Brooklyn Dodger fans. It doesn't matter. But yes, the now Indianapolis Colts are back. The Baltimore Ravens will play them, and half the city will be happy no matter what happens.
Well, there you go. And other football, too. We have a lot of games on tap this weekend, a lot going on in the world of sports. Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, covers sports and a whole lot more every week on his show. Don't miss it. And Bill, thank you as always.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Rising country star Bradley Walker remembers growing up in Athens, Alabama, and watching the Grand Ole Opry at his grandparents' knee. Now just 28 years old, he listened to George Jones and Merle Haggard when old school country was no longer cool.
Right on the money and off by mile, ahead of my time and way out of style, but I'm hanging tough.
Walker first got up on stage at a local talent show when he was 4 years old. He sang the Oak Ridge Boys' Elvira from the wheelchair that's carried him his entire life. Then there was a moment of epiphany, and bam, he's a bluegrass man. Critics are saying his debut CD, Highway of Dreams, may mean he'll quit his job as a materials analyst at the Browns Ferry Nuclear Plant in Alabama. Bradley Walker stopped by our studios to talk with Here and Now's Robin Young.
What was it about bluegrass? Tell me about that bam moment.
Oh, man, just I had been singing country music for quite some time, all my life up to that point, and a good friend introduced me to J.D. Crow and the New South.
Let's all have a moment of respect.
Exactly, exactly.
Because, people say that's it, that's the record.
That's the record.
What was it about the sound that appealed to you, as opposed to country, you know, more than country?
Well, to me, there's a lot of country music in bluegrass music. You know, bluegrass is and was a kind of a spinoff of country music, I believe. Probably the harmonies, the vocal harmonies.
They're so tight.
Yeah, four or five guys with their instruments come into a home somewhere, no amplifiers, no electrified instruments or anything, you know, just come in yourself and your instruments and have a jam session, you know, and pick and sing, you know.
It's so much more naked or something and ancient. And in fact, I've been enjoying your CD for a while.
Thank you.
And I'm shocked you're so young. I thought, well, what an ancient soul is singing this bluegrass here. I also had no idea you were in a wheelchair. And I do want to ask you about that because it makes its way into talking to you about music because you have muscular dystrophy. You have the kind that can early onset, obviously, since birth. It doesn't seem to have affected your lungs. Do you feel it in your singing?
No. I'm very blessed, and the form of MD that I have is a non-progressive form. So it's not something that's going to get worse over time. That is just a real blessing, you know, and
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, you know, so I feel great. I couldn't have asked for a better year in 2006, I mean, to get the record deal and to then finally see the reaction from folks when they get to hear the finished product, you know, and to hear that people really like it as much as we enjoyed putting it together.
And let's hear some more of this voice. We've guessed that one of your musical heroes is Lefty Frizzell. You sing one of his songs on the CD. It's called I Never Go Around Mirrors. Let's listen.
Just see a grown man crawl is more than I can stand. And I can't look into the eyes of half a man.
It's the hard-drinking guy and heartbroken agony. Are you one of those guys? I mean, sometimes we start to hear the stories that infuse the music, and it's like, oh, yeah, I had to, you know, drag myself up from some, you know, ditch somewhere in order to sing this song. Where, you know, what are you putting in the song?
Well, naturally, you know, a lot of what I sing about, luckily I haven't been through myself, you know.
Because we wouldn't be here.
Exactly. But I don't know if it's, you know, some of the songs on my record are songs that I can relate to. To me, they can be delivered a whole lot better if you can somehow relate to the music and what the song is saying.
Like what? Give us one that's...
Well, Lost at Sea is probably my favorite track on the record. And it just tells a great story, you know, of a guy who's out here looking for somebody that he's looking for the love of his life, you know, and he knows she's out there somewhere, and he hopes to find her one of these days. He just keeps searching and searching because he knows she's out there somewhere.
Just listen.
And I keep thinking I see your face, but it's gone without a trace. Oh, I've been every place I thought you'd be. Why have I just gone drifting on and on? When, baby, you're the one who's lost at sea.
There's another one on the CD, and I'm wondering, you know, we mentioned that do you still work at Browns Ferry Nuclear Power Plant?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Doing what?
I'm a material analyst there. A lot of reports, a lot of those kinds of things.
So I'm thinking of paying your dues.
Oh, yeah.
About, you know, going to work every day. Let's listen to that.
He'd like to end that dirty grind, kick back for a while. Take his wife on an ocean voyage to some exotic isle. Dress her up in silk and lace and all your finer things. Their expensive taste will have to wait because they're a little short of green.
Bradley Walker's paying your dues from his new debut CD. It's called Highway of Dreams. It's the kind of music we came to expect before the new country. You know, mm-hmm. Talking about, as you said, looking for lost love, looking to find a love, talking about, you know, an average person going to work.
Mm-hmm.
The new music, patriotism, NASCAR. How do you feel about the distinction between good old and new country?
I think there's good in every form. I'm a song guy. You know, I really like to hear great songs that tell great stories. From the paying your dues side of things to the Lost at Sea, where you're looking for somebody or those are real subjects, you know. Those are things that people go through, and they're songs that people can relate to in some way or another, and those are the kind that I like to sing.
You know, when you say you're a song guy, again, if someone missed the beginning here, we spoke about you being in a wheelchair. You've got MD, thankfully not the progressive kind,
mm-hmm.
muscular dystrophy. But I'm wondering, you know, how transporting is that, you know, to have that voice and be on stage and be in that song? Maybe, I don't know, not in the wheelchair, you know, for me.
Yeah, it's the best feeling in the world. I mean, people who don't sing don't really probably get the full, what we're even talking about here. But when I'm on stage and am able to be around a great bunch of musicians who know the music, and where all I have to do is just get up there and sing and throw myself totally into the song, man, it's just... Everything else goes away. You know, what I've done the past week at work or what I've got to do next week, all that goes away, you know, and I'm just up there singing the song and having a great time, you know. But I think for the most part, and I've heard from a lot of people that once they hear the songs and once they hear me sing, then all that just kind of fades away, you know, and that's what I like, you know, because it shouldn't really be an issue. I'm just a singer. Sure, the wheelchair's there. It's not going anywhere, but that's not who I am, you know. I'm somebody who just loves good music and loves sharing it with other people.
Bradley Walker's debut CD is called Highway of Dreams. For more on the CD and his touring schedule, go to our website, here-now.org. They let you out from the nuclear power plant.
Yes, they
tour.
Did.
Smart people. Bradley, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Here and Now's Robin Young speaking with rising bluegrass star Bradley Walker.
I was standing at the station with a suitcase in my hand. She was barely 17, I wasn't quite a man. Porter hollered, all aboard, take those tickets, please. I kissed her for the last time.
then she turned to me. Lord, I should have took that train. It ain't never rolling down this track again.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a good weekend and join us again Monday, Here and Now.
Lord, I should have took that train.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.